CliffCentral.com.
Alrighty, good morning, everybody. I don't know why, but this thing's not. Doesn't seem like we're going live quickly enough. Trying to figure out what's going on here.
I can sort that from my end.
Can you? Oh, look at you in the middle of the forest, and you can sort it out better than me.
Well, it's about chakra. You know what I mean? I'm living my best life.
Alright, well, you can you do that from there?
Yeah, it's done. It's done. We are live. We are a go.
Really? Because it doesn't look like on my side. Anyway, all right. Well, I'll take your word for it. Simpiwe will let us know. All right. Very good. This morning, we've got Mbulelo in the middle of some forest in the Eastern Cape somewhere. And we have Gilly Upta, who is in... Are you in Joburg or in Cape Town at the moment? And I saw you also went overseas lately. You've been all over the place.
I'm in the forest of Stanton.
It counts. No, that's the real forest. That's the proper concrete jungle in this country. Things happen there.
That's right.
Well, I'm hoping that everything is live and you can hear and see us and join us online. If it's on YouTube, on our podcast app, on any of the other podcast apps, you are welcome this morning. We're going to get into it in just a second. So, Mbulelo, how's it going down there? What's news?
Lots of incredibly fit looking, and it does make you realize that your life has passed. They look incredible. Yeah, that's the most special place in the world, really. You can't build any mucking about. I'm in somewhere called Tsitsikamma, in just past George, an incredible place. Incredible. There's no complaining. Incredibly fit people. Sad that I'm still single when. Like, there are so many hot chicks here. It's incredible how hot athletic chicks are.
Wow.
Why are you surrounded by so many attractive women?
Yeah. What have you done wrong or right?
Because I'm at a trail run. So I'm at. So where people actually care about themselves, they're not just caring about spicy pumpkin lattes or whatever nonsense is in fancy, you know. So it's fantastic.
I'm like the target market for that, and I have to say I've never seen a spicy pumpkin latte on any menu anywhere in Stanton.
Oh, it's
I hate to break it to you.
It's a big thing in America though for Halloween. Anything pumpkin is like off the charts successful. And you know how many Americans make a bigger fuss of Halloween than they do of Christmas or Thanksgiving or anything else? They love it. They dress up. They decorate their houses. Yeah. They decorate their streets. It's coming up at the end of this year. But I've noticed South Africans are starting to do some of that stuff too. That Halloween shit.
We've jumped onto that bandwagon in the last, I would say, 5 years. Uh-huh. I think we're excited about the costumes.
Yeah.
You know.
Any excuse to get dressed
fun.
Up. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, man. All right, so, Gilly, what's been happening with you?
I'm still having phantom problems. Sorry, before you ask Gilly, so I brought a mic, and now my mic's not being picked up. So I probably sound like I'm doing this from inside of a tin can, which is making me mad.
No, you sound all right, actually. You don't sound too bad at all.
Sounds pretty clear.
No.
All right, awesome.
I wouldn't worry about it.
Yeah.
So, Gilly, what's been happening with you? I saw you hanging out with Nina Hasty the other day.
I often hang out with Nina Hasty. You know, there are very few women in my industry, in the comedy industry, so we tend to enjoy being around each other and sharing our trials and tribulations with each other, you know?
And Nina has serious trials and tribulations any day of the week and twice on Sunday.
She does.
She would admit.
Especially the tribulations, that one.
she's an extremely, she's actually a very sensitive human being, our Nina Hasty. She's worked with us at Cliff Central pretty much from the get-go. She used to do a show with Trevor Gumbi, which was... Just an
ah yes.
Oh my God, it was off the wall. It was probably the most dangerous show I've ever heard, and I've listened to radio from all over the world because with those two, and I think Trevor was still.
No, that's yeah.
This was pre-rehab Trevor. This was like, you know, the Trevor that genuinely did his absolute best to piss everyone off, and Nina, of course, at that point was
pre-rehab Nina.
It was as well, and she was. They were enablers each other.
That sounds wild. Yeah, that sounds wild. It sounds wild. That sounds fun. Those are two very fun people.
They're fun people, but my God, I'm surprised.
With a lot of crazy ideas.
I'm surprised we didn't get locked up. They just didn't come and arrest the whole lot of us for being associated with them because They would make the most crass and like you. The words politically correct don't even help to describe the opposite of what they do. These two, they used to have conversations about, you know, but they would try to make each other laugh as well. They had conversations about race and sex and rape and incest and just the most. Yeah, and they held no candle for anybody. There were no sacred cows. It was just extremely hectic the whole time. My God.
Well, those are two very fun, interesting, sensitive, intelligent, wild people.
Mm-hmm. Can only lead to trouble.
You know, so.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. We were hanging out. We were shooting something, but, you know, we're trying to get this industry going again, I guess. That's what all the comedians are up to.
Well,
there isn't really much of an industry. There are very few gigs, you know, so.
But I saw you on stage at a thing on your Instagram the other day, and I saw some others as well. What was that all about?
Yes. It depends where, what you saw, but in the last 2 weeks, I guess, there have been a couple of shows. There have been some open mic shows. We did the mm-hmm. Joburg International Comedy Festival this past weekend, which was very fun. Usually it's quite a big festival. Here in Joburg, it's been running for about 4 or 5 years. And on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, they had it in a sort of a minimized version of it, you know. But they did a really great job of doing, like, I think 8 shows or 10 shows in what is essentially 2 rooms
amazing.
At a hotel. And it was really fun. It was super professional. The comedians were excellent, and it was really great, yeah.
And now with level one or whatever we're on, I mean, does that open it up yet? Because I think that the only things that are still under lock and key are like sporting events and things, or can comedy take place now?
You know, I think comedy can take place. It's in small enough rooms usually anyway. Like we, you know, there's a lot of like comedians who are like, during the pandemic, we're like, oh, you know, we can't fill out rooms. I was like, bruh, you weren't even filling out rooms when it was allowed. What are you talking about?
Love it.
Filling out rooms. Don't care about filling rooms. So, you know, yeah, we have like a situation where people are like, oh, we're sold out, but it's like 10 seats because of COVID.
But
sellout is a sellout.
You did go to London and was it Lithuania?
Ooh, I went to a lot of places.
Yeah.
I went to a lot of places, Gareth. I went all over Europe on a comedy tour.
Wow.
It's a tour that I've been on before, and I was asked to join again. It was postponed. And also, initially, I was supposed to go on this tour, and I was it's really fun and exciting, you know, any day. But then after a year and a half of not doing comedy or traveling or doing anything that much, it was even more thrilling and exciting. And it took a lot of, like, mental and emotional fortitude to actually figure out how to get there and, you know, like, that whole story. Because traveling, I tell you, traveling right now, if you go to one place and you stay there, that's fine. But traveling from one place to another right now is treacherous. I managed to do it and managed to go all over, perform all over. Yeah, I was in Lithuania, in Latvia, in Estonia.
Sure.
That whole Baltic region.
Yeah.
And in Germany, spent quite a lot of time in Germany. I was in London. I was in Amsterdam. I went to a lot of places, did a lot of comedy. It was great.
That sounds phenomenal, especially to hazard that now. And were people kind of, were they very uptight still about Corona? Because you say travel was a bit of a nightmare or it was difficult.
You know, well, I went to Switzerland and they're uptight anyway, so.
Yeah, exactly.
You know.
Yeah, that's true.
I went to Germany, and I like to do jokes about like Hitler and Jewish people, and it really upsets them. So it's fun for me, and not that fun for them. But that's fine. I mean, you know,
it's pretty much illegal to.
Somebody
do
has to have
like
a good
that.
Time.
The Germans, the Germans are still kind of sensitive about that, which is ironic.
Well, you know, they.
Which is ironic.
Oh, yeah,
since,
it is ironic.
Since,
but
since
they
you're
are.
Jewish.
They have to hear it, you know. As a Jewish person who comes to them with a joke about the thing that they've done, they have to take it, which I respect. Like, I wish we had that kind of openness in a way to it here in this country to talk about things that, you know, we don't want to hear necessarily, you know.
Well, I feel like I don't feel like it's been a long time since we had you on the show, because follow your Instagram and these, hello, it's me Gilly, videos of yours are awesome. And actually, Tracy says the same thing in the comments this morning. So those are fantastic. And it's become like a thing. You scroll and scroll and you go through people's stories and then something like that comes up and you actually stop and you go, ah, good, it's time for a little dose of this. It's awesome.
That's nice. Tell that to the many people who are unfollowing me daily.
What?
I can't. So many people unfollow me. I just get unfollowed and unfollowed. I mean, I think overall I get followed, but...
But are you...
Maybe it's the Germans. Yeah. Maybe it's the Germans after the Hitler thing. Like, that filters into their stream, and then they're like, oh, no, who is this? You know, and then we got to get out of here. Auf Wiedersehen into your profile, you know?
Mm.
I think you might be right about that.
I know what I know.
I will say, like, I have to tell you, like, I do these videos every day because I committed myself to doing a video every single day this year.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, I absolutely hate it.
Do you? Do you?
It's I don't know how you do this job every day, Gareth, honestly. Like, so, every day I'm like, not another one.
So you feel pressure to create stuff? Yeah, I mean, like, on a consistent basis, because it is a pain.
Yes, but that was the point. Yeah, that was the point. The whole point was to force myself into a situation where I have to try to create something or write something or think about a concept, you know, conceptualize something every single day. It's not just about getting up there and talking shit. You know, it's about like, can I conceptualize something every day? And I don't think I succeed every day, but at least I'm building that muscle, you know?
Yeah.
But you know what it sounds like, Gilly? You know, when you transition from like, oh, we're dating and we live in our own apartments, and then you do the marriage thing, and now you've got to be there when his dirty socks are on the floor, now you're like committed. It's another thing. Absolutely. We live together, and now I have to see his mother because you know what I mean? Every Sunday's a family thing. Yeah,
100%. I was just dating social media before this. Now we're in a long-term, serious, committed relationship. And let me tell you something. I am going to break up with social media on the 31st of December.
Well, Gilly, let me tell you something. Number one, you're so brave, because that's a thing to say now, by the way.
Yeah,
you're so brave.
Thank you, yes.
And also...
We love that.
Yeah.
You are so brave. And also thoughts and prayers. Yeah, no, like marriage isn't for everyone.
Hashtag less.
Is there anything more patronizing than being told you're brave for doing something that isn't brave? You know, it's like...
Let me tell you what's worse. You've just been on stage, okay? Mm. You've been on stage for, like, I don't know how long. This often happens at... My friend Claudine and I, Claudine's also a comedian, a Jewish comedian, and we found that often we get off stage, if we're doing a Jewish event, for example, like a Jewish fundraiser or something like that, it's often women who come up to us afterwards and they go, honestly, you are so brave. I don't know how you do it. And it's like, it took me a long time to understand what that was. And then I realized, these people they think when I come out on stage, they actually are terrified for me. They think this is going to go badly. Mm. And so they're actually very nervous the whole time, like waiting for it to go wrong, because it's like I'm like one of their children.
Yes.
And if it goes badly for me, listen, if this goes badly for me and I'm not married and I don't have kids, I mean, they're just going to die. It's going to just be the end of my... It's like, it's not even bad for me. It's so bad for them, you know. They can't handle it.
But it's a funny thing. There seems to be this, and I don't know if it's just a Jewish thing, because there are lots of other people who aren't Jewish who feel the same way, that they kind of, as you say, they expect it to go really badly, whatever it is. So yes. It could be a meal. It could be... it could be a business meeting. This is going to go so badly. You can hear them saying it in their heads. And then when it doesn't go that way, they're almost like relieved. And then some miracle happened. Even though it was a perfectly okay, simple, straightforward, easy thing for the person in question to do, to them, it's like, oh, God, everything's going to go badly. I always wonder, like, what it's like, because I've never...
That is a Jewish thing. And to be fair, it usually does go badly for us.
Well, historically, it hasn't been easy. Let's put it that way.
So you know what I mean. We have to maintain a little bit of like skepticism in any situation, yeah, just for safety.
No, that's probably about right.
No, it's called Jewish angst. Like, that's exactly a real thing. People would, like, literally call it Jewish angst.
Yeah.
In the community. So again, is thoughts and prayers, and you're so brave knowing that that's gonna, you know, happen to Gilly and Claude. Eh? I don't know if I can call her that.
Claude.
Yeah, you can. Oh. You can. Thank you. Claudine, Claude. We appreciate you know, your support during this difficult
She's
time.
Just so nice, that Claudia. She, like, I just wish she'd get married.
Claudine, man.
Oh.
Yes, sus.
No, sorry, I was thinking of Meryl's child, who's just gotten married, by the way, to Joshua Livitz, and it's going unbelievably well. He's a dentist, he's the best, I'm telling you.
You can see Mbulelo lives in the middle of Morningside. You know, you can tell.
Yes, absolutely.
He's his
actual. I'm sure, but you know what? In his defense, I'm sure he gets called Mbulelo all the time.
I just want to go to comment from Lawrence.
So you know,
Lawrence,
we all have our struggles.
Lawrence says, here's a weird story, and I have no reason to not believe him. A guy contacted me and was willing to pay for me to make animated porn of his wife.
I take it Lawrence is an animator.
I mean,
But what's porn?
The question
is, that just
is what is the reference material that he's going to be that,
Exactly. Gilly, well said.
I mean, there's got to be, he's obviously got to supply pictures of his wife, this dude. And I'm just curious.
I think this is a great idea. You know, this guy was like, I love my wife, I love porn, let's put our hands together.
This is not straightforward, like just, you know, roll the cameras and film a little private porno for us. This is like animated as well. I want like cartoon versions of my wife.
So he's obviously, he's got that, it's so funny, it's into that, maybe they had a fight and she was like, you, it's me or the porn, and he was like, hang on a second,
I can solve this, yeah. That's incredible.
You've got to do it.
Yeah.
And also, let's say what everyone's thinking is, how hot is she? I mean, if she's incredibly good looking, you've got to do it.
Mm.
Why? What difference does it make? He's into her. He thinks she's hot, obviously.
And sometimes it's easier.
No, I'm saying the animator.
Yeah, but sometimes it's easier to draw people if they're not really good looking. Like, you've got to find some, especially if you're a cartoonist, you've got to find something about them that's a bit weird. And then, you know, maybe she's got a big chin or like buck teeth or something like that. Then it's easier to draw her and it'll look more like her in the cartoon. So from an animator's point of view, that's quite interesting. Ruth says, yes, Lawrence. Indeed, it could become a huge thing. Anime porn is huge, so Ruth knows about this. So clearly, that's a thing. Tracy says...
That whole world is very real, by the way. Like, I have friends that are into anime, and then they'll just weirdly, like, show me that stuff. Like, why are you showing me Japanese cartoon porn? Like, why is this happening? And it's a massive thing, by the way. Like, weird.
Well, Tracy's a photographer. She says she often gets requests for boudoir shoots. No thanks. It's never for the husband. It's always for the guy on the side. So by boudoir shoots, you mean like what? Like, you know, sexy kind of lingerie and nude stuff in their house, or, you know, in a studio. That's interesting stuff. People are being much more open about that kind of thing these days. You could see, like, some people, even in their Instagram, they're like hinting at how they do, you know, more than just the straightforward model clothes thing. Now they'll do the whole nine yards. It's pretty amazing. Lawrence just adding in there that she wasn't very good looking, the woman in question. Okay. See, that helps. That helps.
To you, Lawrence.
Tell me quickly, when we just go back to your travels for a little bit. I've never been to the Baltic, and Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, obviously they're on that sea, and it's pretty chilly there in the middle of winter. But what is it like? Because you obviously went now in summer, right? What are those places?
Well, I thought
even like? What are the people like?
The people are interesting in the Baltics. They are very sensitive about how they're seen in terms of Eastern Europeans. They don't think of themselves as Eastern Europeans. You tell them they're Eastern Europeans, they're insulted. So they're like Central Europeans. They're Central Europeans. And in places like Estonia, they like to almost think of themselves as Scandinavian because they're so like far north. They're almost in, Finland, I think, is the closest place to it.
Yeah.
And so, but I got to tell you, like, you know, as a foreigner, You know, it feels very Eastern European. That's the vibe. And well, I was told, in fact, that when I went to there's a place called Klaipėda in Lithuania, which was one of the cities we performed in. It's Klaipėda and Vilnius, the main.
Capital.
Yes, the main like cities. Vilnius is the capital, and we went to a place called Klaipėda. And the person that I was traveling with, who's traveled to all these places before, told me. He said to me, "Prepare yourself because in Klaipėda they will not laugh. This is the hardest room on the tour. Like they will be. Just prepare yourself for not hearing much laughter. And they come to the shows, so they clearly enjoy them. But just be ready. They're a little bit cold.
But I mean, to me, to you, to anyone else, what's the bloody distinction between Central or Eastern European? We don't give a shit. To us, it's purely like geographical. And if you ask me what's Central, I'd say Germany or Poland. Maybe the Czech Republic.
Yeah, it depends on, you know, their history. You know, it depends on their history and how insecure they are as a nation, you know, in
those
places and what they...
Those countries are always worried about being rolled over by Russia because that's happened before.
Yes, correct. And you know, it's so funny because the guy that I was traveling with knew so much about these places and he kept telling me everything. And I absorbed maybe 1% of what he says most of the time. I'm more of like a feeling person, you know, like get into a place and feel what it's like, you know. Yeah. I'll tell you, I went to the hairdresser in Riga in Latvia, okay, because we were filming a show that night and I wanted to have nice hair. And you can learn more from sitting in at a hairdresser than almost any other, like any other scenario, you know what I mean? Because you see what people are really like you see how people do their jobs and you see... It's very interesting. Like you just saw women. The thing about like that part of the world, you see these beautiful women and they strut. Every single one of them thinks that they are a supermodel about to be discovered. And
really?
So they like walk down the street. Yeah. They walk down the street with like, I can't even explain it, with like this intention and their hair is perfect and they're all a little bit gaunt.
Maybe they are looking for a husband from another country to sweep them off their feet and take them out of cold Latvia.
Yeah, listen,
real thing in Belgrade. Like, that's a real thing in Belgrade. There's like a very famous strip where the ladies just do that. And in the Czech Republic. So I used to date a Slovakian chick, so I know exactly what Gilly's talking about with that whole central thing. But an interesting thing about Estonia is, I don't know, Gilly, when you were there... So they make a lot of cabins for other ski resorts. It's like a really famous thing to have an Estonian, and they make them and ship them off completely. Yeah, it's like a really big thing there. Yeah, so if you go to ski resorts around the world, a lot of the cabins you'll be staying in will be made in Estonia because they make it at like rock bottom prices, but they do it as well as anybody. Really, really interesting.
Wow.
Yeah, that place I found to be distinct from the other places in the Baltics in terms of the attitude of the people. They do feel like Nordic, you know what I mean? The even the way the town looks, it looks kind of medieval. And the people there are very like straight up, but very like, I don't know, like down to earth, hardworking kind of people, you know? So I can see them building a cabin.
There are a lot of so just to go back to an earlier thing about the kind of Jewish community in South Africa, and I know we were making fun of it, but there are a lot of South African Jews whose ancestors do come from Lithuania.
Yeah, absolutely. And so when I went there, a lot of people were like, "Can you get me my birth certificate? My grandfather's birth certificate. We're trying to get a passport so we can get the fuck out of here."
So the reason a lot of people left Lithuania all those years ago was because there were huge pogroms and massive kinds of it was like a tacit genocide. They weren't made to feel very welcome. There were people who were chased around. They weren't allowed to run businesses. The Jewish community.
I mean, chased around and not made to feel welcome is a very polite way to put it.
I mean, there were also open hostilities against the Jewish community there, and many of them decided to get on ships and just see wherever the ships would take them because anything was better than being there. And those places.
And I mean, most of South Africa's Jewish community are either from Latvia or Lithuania.
Mm. So there's a lot of history.
Almost
there.
Every single Jewish person you know,
is
from that region. in South Africa.
Ashkenazi.
That's right.
Yeah.
That is right.
So there are clearly a lot of people who want to talk about this boudoir shoot thing, and I've got like a couple of minutes before we get to the headlines. So here's Tracy again, who's the photographer. She says, a friend of a friend had a boudoir shoot, made a coffee table book, and would show it off to all her husband's friends when they would rock up for a visit. She was pretty, but instant blush and awkwardness. Jesus. Wow.
Well, I can tell you that I know a couple. I know a couple. It was my friend's cousins, a very wealthy couple.
Mm-hmm.
And I used to take a lot of photos at the time. Like, I was very into my photography. And he wanted to have a painting of his wife made by a painter. Mm-hmm. No, sorry. She wanted to have a painting of herself made for her husband on his birthday. It was like his 50th birthday or something. And so she asked me to take the photos of her. And they were quite like provocative lingerie photographs. And she was very beautiful. And yeah, it worked out pretty well. And but every now and again, I by mistake come across those photos. And I'm like, in like 30 years when I forget who this woman is, this is going to be so weird when I'm like rifling through photos and find photos of this half-naked woman like amongst all of my belongings.
Yeah, that sounds, that sounds dodgy as hell. You know, I've also – I think that these days it's not – as difficult because everybody's got camera phones and we don't remember that like 10 years ago it was a thing to take pictures. You needed a camera, needed to be a good quality camera, you needed to have pictures developed.
Absolutely.
Okay, not 10 years, maybe 15 years ago, where it was a big deal. You couldn't just put a camera up and take a couple of selfies with the other side of the phone, you know. It was much more difficult.
And I used to love it. I used to love doing it. And now that you say that, I realize the more the technology has advanced, the less I've enjoyed taking photos. It seems just too, it's very disposable, you know.
Yeah,
I'm very much less invested in the art of photography that now.
Well, also everyone thinks they're a photographer these days. Everybody thinks that they've got the requisite skills to actually be able to do this as a hobby or professionally. I mean, it is the world's number one hobby. But to be a professional photographer is a very different thing to being somebody who can use an iPhone.
That's true.
Yeah. No, that's true. Also, I think the advent of sort of Instagram and the chicks that are deadlifting, so they've got those glutes, is that we're less sensitive to nudity now. So people are more likely to go, ah, Gilly, won't you just pop over, won't you do me the mitzvah of just showing my nipples for a coffee book table that I want to show all of my friends at the bar mitzvah that's coming up. You know what I mean? Like, we're just open to it now because nudity is everywhere. Yeah. The internet is 80% porn or whatever.
I mean, listen, there are people who are making a living out of just posting naked pictures of themselves now. And,
exactly.
And we joked we spoke about Nina just now, but Nina said to me on the last occasion she was on the show, she told me that she was getting a lot of requests from creepy guys to do foot pictures, and she was going to start an OnlyFans with her feet. She said there were huge numbers of people who were asking her on an almost weekly basis, like, please post a picture.
Honestly, I don't see the harm there.
Yeah, post a picture.
Feet out, money in. Excellent.
You
excellent
also,
trade.
You wouldn't have a problem with that.
Feet, no problem. Hmm. You want to pay me for my feet, you moron? I will give you the feet.
I saw a diagram yesterday of a human leg, right? It's drawn like crudely in pencil or whatever. And then it's got colors ranging from dark at the top to light at the bottom. And it says the lighter end of the spectrum makes it less socially acceptable to have a fetish, and that the top end of the spectrum makes it more. So in other words, as you go down the leg towards the foot, your fetish becomes less and less socially appropriate, and people look at you more askance.
That's so funny.
It is hilarious. Anyway. All right. Ruth just telling us to please remember to click the like and subscribe buttons and all that shit. We always forget to say this, so thanks for the reminder, Ruth. Okay. Do some headlines quickly. Let's look at what's going on in the world. First things first, Facebook obviously went down, and people were talking about that all day yesterday. Zuckerberg has apologized for the six-hour outage. He said Their social media services went down for almost 6 hours, impacting more than 3.5 billion users worldwide. He said sorry after an internal technical issue took Facebook offline, and also WhatsApp and Instagram. The scramble to bring it back eventually succeeded at around 10 o'clock South African time. It's likely to increase scrutiny of the social media giant's reach. For hours, potentially billions of people found themselves without the social media tools they relied upon to keep in touch with friends and family. Others reportedly found they could not access services which required a Facebook login. Meanwhile, businesses around the world, which use social media to connect with customers, were faced with the prospect of an unexpected financial hit. See, we don't think about that. It's a big deal for companies and for people who are, you know, whose business is online.
I read about an article about how a lot of people, like across Africa, who use Facebook and Instagram for sales, like just people who are hawkers or just independent people who use the all of the social media platforms for their business, just like collapse their entire businesses, but small tiny little businesses, you know.
Well, also, it really does show us how dependent we've become on this one guy and his three companies. And if we don't have them, we almost feel like we're disconnected from the world. You almost feel like you've lost a friend for a little bit because you can't get hold of anybody. You don't know what else to use. I mean, I tried to use SMS. You remember SMSs?
I did too.
And my SMSs wouldn't even go through, so I don't know if my
phone... I had something worse happen. Someone phoned me.
Oh, my God. What did you...
I hear you. What did you do?
Yeah, how do you even respond to that? Like a call. What do you even do with a call?
Like, gross. What are you doing?
But nobody's talking about the real victims. What about the CEOs that are obviously having an affair with their sort of PAs? So, you know, that was a tough 8 hours for them.
I mean, maybe they needed a break, you know.
Fair point. Every affair needs a break.
Here's a story from, and this is really quite something. This is a story about these Department of Basic Education. They fired 11 teachers, including those charged with sexual assault against pupils. I just can't believe it's only 11 that they fired, because you know in this country we've got a big problem with teachers who sleep with students, and it happens far more regularly than anyone wants to talk about. The South African Council for Educators said it investigated 443 cases against teachers, ranging from assault to theft, sexual harassment against pupils and teachers, and even sexual violence against pupils. In its annual report, which was tabled before Parliament, said some of the teachers were found guilty of sexual violence. In Gauteng, there were 4 teachers who were fired for sexual assault, followed by Mpumalanga with 3 teachers who were removed for severe assault of pupils and locking a pupil in a storeroom. In the Northwest, Western Cape and Free State, 3 teachers were fired for sexual assault against pupils.
That's only the ones who were caught.
Correct. And out of 443 cases, we only got to fire 11 teachers? Don't tell me there are only 11 who are guilty of this nonsense. 443.
I find this subject incredibly, incredibly depressing. It's just like... How does it end, you know?
Yeah, and they said that numbers...
Very hard to protect.
Despite the fact that people didn't spend as much time at school, the numbers are still really, really high over the last 2 years, which shows you that when you send your kids to school, particular schools are obviously bigger offenders than others. You just don't know whether they're safe or not.
You know, when I was in Switzerland, and I was walking from... into the town, and I was crossing this like a double carriageway kind of a road, and I was going to the tram, and there was a policeman standing beside the tram by the traffic lights, and I wanted to ask him if I was about to get on the right tram, and he's like a very tall, strapping policeman,
yes.
And he said to me, I said, excuse me, and he said, one moment, and he said, I must watch the children cross the road, and he was there at the traffic light to watch school children who were coming home from school, and they weren't small. They were like 9 or 10.
Yeah.
And he was put there to watch those kids cross the road and make sure that they got to the other side of the street safely. I mean, and this was a big proper road with correct signage, and these kids are old enough. And I just thought, There's a man appointed to watch these children cross the road. And he wasn't like an old schlenter cop with nothing to do. He was a tall, young, he was the best. He was like their finest sent out into the road to watch these kids cross the road, you know. And I was like, and there were maybe like 10 of them, and two at a time. I was like, who's watching our kids? No one.
You know, the old adage is that if you want to see how a country should be evaluated, you look at how they treat their weakest and their smallest and their least capable in terms of defending themselves. And if you don't look after your children as a country, you really have nothing to boast about. And we give South Africa a lot of shit, which it deserves. But honestly, I don't think there are a lot of countries in the world where children die in pit toilets at school, which is to me just the most undignified, horrendous, just horrific, terrifying death you could imagine for a small child. And then you see...
Absolutely.
You see that so many of these kids go to school and they're predated upon by these shithead teachers who are
insane.
They're like these horrible, traumatized, incapable, insecure, pathetic adults who like take out their frustrations on children, and especially the ones who like rape these young ladies at school and then get them pregnant. And, you know, it's almost like the parents and the schools themselves just kind of, you know, they just wave it on like, oh, well, you know, it happens. We have the highest rate of pregnancies in schools where the perpetrators of these things, the impregnators, are teachers, not other pupils. It's very upsetting.
It is very upsetting, and it also like it's hard from a community support situation because so many parents are under pressure, or so many of these kids don't even have parents. Hmm. So there's not a lot of guidance. There's not a lot of focused attention for like each child. I've made a lot of like videos in schools all around the country, and it's. You can just see it. You can see how unattended to so many kids are, you know?
Mm. Yeah.
And I think the double whammy here is that we now know with revelations coming out, I mean, largely speaking, we're still a sort of a Catholic country, is that we can't even send our kids to the churches anymore. You know, like we know what sort of monsters lurk in those halls. So like, what do we do? Like, and like you said, a place where your women and children are not safe is not a place to live. And South Africa is headed to a scary place. We need to get a hold of our schools and our churches ASAP, because it's a monstrosity out there.
Can we just talk about the room that you're in? You're in a tent, it looks like, where there's – are those benches or are those – is that a drinking establishment or is it just a meeting room?
No.
Tell us what's going on there.
Yeah.
I mean, as much as I was talking down the churches, they are probably the best at getting a cult going. I am getting a cult going here. I've just branded it Otter because it's become famous. So we're starting a church in here, and I'll be collecting tithe. And yes, you can pay with SnapScan before you ask. No, this is where we're going to be doing all of the briefings and all of the meetings for athletes as they arrive. Yeah. You get briefed because this isn't a park run. You know, if you don't behave yourself, you can fall off a mountain and die. So. We got to look after these guys.
It does look like the kind of place that that you have heavy drinking afterwards, though. I mean, I'm just saying.
Oh, yeah. Well, let me see if I can quickly – I don't know if you're getting this, but a lot of the heavy drinking will happen out there. Not sure if you are seeing is a beer tent.
I'm sorry. Anywhere you see those barrels that are placed strategically around the room, anywhere you see those, you just know there's going to be the drinking that happens alongside them. So these may be athletes, they may be people who take the trail run very seriously, but they're also people who can obviously drink quite heavily, because otherwise they wouldn't have those barrels lying around.
A big part of trail running is getting absolutely hammered on good quality craft beer. Like it's sort of a part of it, you know. So guys like to get after it on both ends.
I think most people end up on a trail run because they agreed to it while they were drunk.
Yes.
Otherwise, you know.
Why would you do that? Terrible thing to spend your time doing. My God.
I don't ever feel the need to run unless I'm running away from something.
Yeah, from a teacher who's trying to have sex with you at school, for example. That's a good reason to run. Otherwise, why bother?
For example.
Yeah. That's not a way to spend your time.
It really isn't.
We've got one or two other things in the news I want to get to, and we've got Sean Saunders joining us just a little bit later on. So we're marching steadily towards having our own new digital vaccination certificate. This is great news for those people who are vaccinated, because it'll allow you to get around. Sorry, I just got COVID. Yes.
Oh no, COVID. Oh, COVID. COVID got you. Oh my Lord.
I had to share my COVID with you digitally. No, I'm kidding.
Thank you so much.
So I went for the first of my vaccinations on Monday, and that sneeze has nothing to do with COVID, I can assure you. But the digital vaccination certificate is coming out, and you cannot believe how excited some people are. You'd think that this was an early Christmas for some of these idiots. South Africa's COVID-19 digital vaccine certificate went live without any announcement. It comes after President Cyril Ramaphosa said the country would have to have standardized proof of vaccination in order to facilitate travel. I mean, that's why I went.
But look
to mine.
We need it, Gareth. Here's why we're excited. Look at the size of this thing. I mean, I might as well have a child. Like if I want to be going to Lithuania for all the incredible looking people with Gilly, imagine I pitch up with this. They think I'm from 1850. Look at the size of the thing. I've got a massive head, Gareth. Massive head. Look at this. It's the size of my head. Look at this. No, come on.
So you. So
you know what? I have to tell you, like, everywhere I went when I was traveling, and it was like I got back maybe 3 weeks ago, and I was traveling for about 2 months, and I cannot tell you the absolute chaos and disarray, even in Europe and places like Germany, that exists when it comes to this stuff. Nobody knows what they're looking at or what they're checking, but everyone's checking something, and you got to have something to show. And every single country has a different requirement for the people coming in, and it's based on whatever country you're coming from. So it's not obvious at all. Like in one place you need a COVID test, a PCR test. In another place you need a vaccine and a COVID test. In another place you just need a rapid test. That's more than enough, and they don't care about your vaccine. In other places they want all the requirements, and then you get there and they don't check. So it's like right now I can tell you all over the world it's chaos.
So did you have to schlep that certificate that Bulelo's just shown us now? Did you have to schlep that around with you?
I did. I took a photo of it and showed it on my phone. And most of the time they just gave it this like cursory glance. You know what I mean? And what you find is that, you know, especially at airports, the people who are behind the counter at the check-in desks, who are tasked with checking all of this documentation, are so stressed out and exhausted because they are constantly dealing with stressed out people who don't have the right documents.
Right.
So when you show up with like your proof of something, they are just so happy to see that you have the thing that they're like, okay, go ahead. I can tell you like the biggest amount of requirements I had was to get into London. And I was coming from Germany, so it shouldn't have been such a drama, but I feel like the EU and London are like having a go at each other with the stuff. And I had a vaccine, and I had to have a PCR test, and I arrive in London. There's two entries at the airport. You know, there's the EU passport, British passport, and then non-British passport. Mm-hmm. British passport, line is packed. Queue is packed. Non-British passport, non-EU passport. The line is empty, and I was
really?
Like,
"That's fantastic." Usually, it's the other way around.
Fantastic, but scary. Scary because I was like, "The people are having so much trouble getting into this place that no one's coming anymore." I was like, "I'm never going to get through whatever this is." Like, I was just so nervous that they. I was nervous, like, for so many reasons, because traveling right now is so like it's so stressful because there's all these additional like hoops you have to jump through. So I arrive at the front. And this woman who looked at my passport just wanted to have a nice conversation with me about where I had traveled. I thought she was checking me to see like which dangerous countries I had been in. No, she just wanted to know where I'd been. We had a nice long chat. She didn't even check that I was vaccinated or ask for my COVID test. And she was like, have a lovely time.
Well, that's fantastic. But I still think you're very brave to be traveling at this point, because it is, as you say, so stressful that it almost takes any of the pleasure out of it, because the whole time you're thinking, I could be sent home.
And you know, you're standing in a queue.
I might not get in. It's horrible.
Totally. You're standing in a queue, and you're like, there's this long queue. Also, you can't do – I was traveling with no luggage. I only had carry-on luggage for this tour, because it's impossible to travel to a city every day and keep having to get your luggage and get on trains and stuff like that. So I ordinarily don't have to go through a check-in process. I have my boarding pass. And in Europe, it's very easy to go from one country to another with a boarding pass. No one checks you. No one checks passports. You can just go through like it's nothing. The same way we travel locally here is how you can travel in Europe. Nobody checks your passport or anything, especially if you're on a train. But if you're at an airport now, suddenly you have to check in, because it's their responsibility to check all these PCR tests and all these documents for all these different countries. So it doesn't matter. Everybody gets put in a queue. And in the queue, it's like getting more and more stressful, because suddenly you hear somebody saying, oh, you're supposed to have this test and that test. But you don't realize that you're standing in a queue with people who are going to different places and coming from different places. So you start basing all of these like criteria. You're like, I'm sure I did the right thing. I'm sure I followed all the instructions. You start reading the instructions again. It's very anxiety riddled.
You know,
3 weeks into this tour, I was exhausted in a way that I couldn't recover from.
I got to tell you something. It reminded me a little bit of how traveling started becoming straight after September the 11th in 2001, because I remember going to New York the year before that in 2000, and it was a piece of cake.
Right. You know,
they weren't nearly the security checks at airports that we had afterwards. And if you can even remember back to that time, you know, you kind of just put your bag through the scanner, and someone kind of gave it a cursory glance on a screen, and they were like, yeah, go through. You didn't really think of it. And post 9/11, I remember going the year after in 2002, and it was just hell. You had to take your shoes off. You had to take your belt off.
It's still hell. In Europe, it's hell to try to get into certain countries, especially like countries like Austria, who really want to stick by the rules. You have to have the right... The 100 mils and the bubbles and
I hate that.
Then every time I'm in those queues, I'm like, fuck those terrorists.
That's horrendous.
Let's not let a terrorist attack go to waste here. The first one you said there we should maybe keep is, if you come to my house, take your shoes off, you animal. Or like, well, what do you think? I'm going to clean my floor every day. I can't stand people who think they can wear shoes inside a house.
Oh, I can't stand people who tell me to take their shoes off.
I hate that too. I refuse it.
How irritating!
Don't invite me to your house and then look at me and go, oh, you're gonna keep those on your feet and walk around.
You know,
my
in
house
Europe, it's
off.
Very common practice, because people come in from like the sleet and the snow and the mud in winter, and so they take their shoes off at the entrance. But like, you know.
Take your shoes off, please. Take your shoes off. They're not that nice. So,
all right.
Take them off. Put them there.
It's time to check in with Sean. Let's go to Sean Sanders in Cape Town. He is the co-founder of Revix, and he joins us this morning. Hey, Sean, how are you doing, man? We can't hear you. I think you're on mute. There we go.
How are you doing, Brad?
Good, man. The office is looking very, very sexy. That's looking nice.
Yeah. We try to win the Zoom game, right? I've said that a few times. It's like we try to look fancy in the background, and you can kind of see a glimmer of a little Table Mountain there.
Through the window. Background.
I thought that was a fake background.
that's exactly what you're going for.
It looks too good to
but
be
it's
true.
Good to be on this morning.
Well, listen.
Yeah, well, I mean, we got all the writing on the wall, right? I mean, that's what you're meant to have when you're fintech and all the rest. We actually got somebody on the show not too long ago. It must have been about a year and a half ago. Mm-hmm. They said we didn't have fancy enough background. So I took that to heart, and I've worked hard since then.
I love it. I also love that we're talking to you on a morning where Bitcoin is $51,342. And just the other day, people were panicking. There were some people who were panic selling. We were going, oh, no, this is terrible for crypto. You and I were talking about the Chinese and how they've tried to shut down cryptocurrencies in China. Well, it seems that crypto is having a very good week.
It is having a very good week. Bitcoin's up, 23% over the last 7 days. And this is really all coming from, I mean, this is on the back of that Chinese ban, right? So, I mean, that's meant to be really bad news. The entire Chinese market is essentially not in crypto anymore. But Yeah, I guess the bigger news this week, and is never a dull day in crypto, but the bigger news is that Bank of America strategists, there's two very well-known guys there, they came out and they advise, I mean, Bank of America is the third biggest bank in the U.S. I mean, yes. It's colossal, right? Bigger than all the South African banks combined times by a factor of 10. But they came out to say that this digital asset, i.e. the crypto universe, is too big to ignore. So this was sort of just another stamp of approval from a big Wall Street bank. And that's led to a lot of money into the space. And I mean, you're talking sort of a lot of the hedge funds and family offices that were sitting on the sidelines going, is this Bitcoin thing real? Is it really going mainstream? They're now coming in. And I mean, if you saw, it's called on exchange flows. So the amount of money that moves onto exchanges, out of fiat currency, like dollars and pounds and all the rest. I mean, that was at a record 2 days ago. So that was a sort of big move into the space, and that's sort of what's driving the prices now. So now you're getting all the skeptics, they're sort of hiding away, and you've got all the Bitcoin proponents and all the rest, they're coming out now, and you're hearing calls of $100,000 by the end of the year. I personally, and you know, again, I always find that when you're looking at future prices, it's a bit of a roll of the dice. Mm. But if you're looking out towards the end of the year, I mean, if you're looking at sort of getting back to our all-time high, which is $65,000, that's 27% from today. I mean, that would be a phenomenal return over the next 3 months or so. $100,000, it's very probable if, and there has to be essentially two big developments that occur.
Yeah.
That Bitcoin ETF we've been speaking about for the last 3 years, that needs to happen. They actually need to be able to have an investment product being this ETF, an exchange-traded fund, which is essentially just something that would provide access to a retail investor, so to an everyday person, that they could go then to the equivalent of, let's say, their Easy Equities or their stockbroking accounts and be able to actually buy cryptocurrencies.
Right.
And that would be a very big sort of step forward in the space. And then another big development would sort of be a some clarity really around the way that they're going to tax cryptocurrencies in the U.S. Because at the moment there's a big question mark around that. And I think those two developments, should they favor crypto? I think you could quite easily see $100,000. And again, the space doesn't move linearly, right? I mean, when you're looking at moves here, this is not a constant 1% move up or down per day.
No.
Like you have days like yesterday, as an example, where Bitcoin went up 7%. And as we've spoken about many times on the show, there's days where it goes down 10%. So if you look at sort of that 80-20 principle, you know, the 80% of returns are produced from 20% of the days. That's sort of the approach that you look at crypto, but you're probably looking at like a 95-5, where there's maybe 5 days that account for 95% of the yearly returns. And it's sort of that old adage as well to say the time in the market is the most important thing, because you can't really time, or you actually just can't time when that's going to happen.
So I've got a couple of questions here, because you know our audience are not idiots. They ask the hard questions. Shiba Inu. What is Shiba Inu or Shiba Inu? What is that all about? Apparently, that has gone up by a couple of 100%.
Yeah.
What is that?
Oh gosh, Shiba Inu is very similar to Dogecoin. Remember, we spoke about that on the show not too long ago.
Yeah.
These are meme-based cryptocurrencies. So, just actually taking a step back. So, to all the listeners that haven't listened to some of the older podcasts where we spoke about Dogecoin. So, back in 2000, and if I'm not mistaken, it was 2017. But I stand to be corrected. It could have been 2018. Dogecoin was created. And the idea around Doge was really to say, listen, you can just print money. You can just print a cryptocurrency. And it was sort of a dig at Bitcoin. It was also a dig at the traditional monetary system that we have today, right? Because the Fed goes, listen, we need more money in society. They kick the printing machine. There's more money that comes out. Obviously, that's an analogy, but that's theoretically what happens. So they created this cryptocurrency. They, being a very small group of guys, created this cryptocurrency, and they just made it as a joke, right? They literally had this dog I forget the breed of the dog.
Yeah.
But that's the logo of this cryptocurrency. They called it Doge. A lot of people call it doggy coin. And it just became this massive meme, like the biggest meme in the crypto space. And then you had Shiba Inu, which, gosh, like got introduced, I don't know, earlier this year, it seemed. And that's also just blown up. But these are completely meme-based cryptocurrencies. They don't function. They don't really do anything, right? Like if I wanted to send you some of this, it works. But it's like kind of, I don't know, it's like me sending you an email. Like, is there really value attached to that email? I don't know. It depends, obviously, what's in that email.
Shiba Inu. It surged 55% 19 hours ago. And then it zoomed to 770%. I mean, that's just incredible. And it's bullshit, really, because it's not any kind of technology, or it's not backing any kind of usefulness. It's just a fad. It's a meme.
Yeah, I mean, this is what's going on in the crypto space right now. I don't know if any of your listeners have got involved with the NFT space, the non-fungible token space.
Yes.
But essentially, you can buy digital representations of real-world objects, or alternatively, and most of the time, it's actually just digital artworks. So you'll have some graphic designer put together a series of artworks, and sometimes they're super cool, sometimes they're complete jokes, but you've had so many people that have made a lot of money recently, and I mean, hell, like everyone at the Revix team right now is going out and buying like these ridiculous NFTs. I'm sorry, I'm not necessarily a big fan of that sort of like NFT.
You see them go for insane amounts of money, and I just don't understand how the prices get attached to them.
Mm.
It's the market, right? I mean, at the end of the day, it's a free market. If you can sell something and somebody else buys it, willing buyer, willing seller. But I think, look, we definitely in this massive, I mean, equivalent to the 2017 ICO boom, you know, where everyone was running around going, buy this weird cryptocurrency, buy that one. You're seeing that in the NFT space. But there are some really interesting projects happening in the background. Dolce & Gabbana came out last Friday, and they essentially have got an NFT collection that you can buy now attached to real-world objects. When you go to Louis Vuitton and you land up buying some more expensive handbags and all the rest, they actually have an NFT chip embedded in them. What's quite cool is recently, and I just decided to do this as a bit of, you know, fun, I invested in a Rolex with my sister and mom, and it was just a collector's Rolex, secondhand. So I was like, okay, right, let me create an NFT. So essentially what we did is we just created this digital token, and attached to this digital token was the purchase date and the identification number that comes with the Rolex.
Yeah.
You can take a photo of when the purchase occurred, and essentially that's the digital certificate of ownership. And what's really interesting about that is if you think about in South Africa, let's say, Gareth, how do you own something? Like, you can go, okay, right, well, I own my home. I can go to a land registrar or whoever it may be, and I could say, listen, you know, tell me that I own this. You can get some sort of a proof. But for pretty much everything else, whether it's your phone, whether it's your laptop, kind of proving ownership is difficult,
it's right? Hard,
like,
right.
The fact that you bought it. And I mean, it's this sort of opportunity that NFTs can actually sort of solve, right? It's this problem that they can solve, because you can have digital ownership of whatever you actually own. And it can say, well, listen, you are the owner of this, and this is the date that the transaction occurred where you purchased it and all the rest. So anyway, that's a,
but surely
I guess
that means that other people can have ownership of something you own too.
If they can prove that, right? So remember, when you are buying that, there should be a transfer from somebody else that owned it to you.
Yeah.
Now that occurs on the blockchain, right? So that'll mean that there is a record that exists somewhere that somebody could search. You can currently go to things like block explorers, and I understand that this is now all getting written in the crypto world, but you can go to these things called block explorers, which are sort of like Google for blockchains, and you can search up a particular transaction. So in that sense, you can verify whether or not this has actually occurred. And if somebody else has copied your NFT or they've copied that ownership certificate, that doesn't really stand if you can, because you're the owner ultimately of that token.
And so
what about
really
if you create like an image of something, like you take a photo of an artwork and then you make that the product?
So that you can do that. Yeah, you definitely can do that. That's one of the beauties with NFT, is it sort of looks, or it takes the art market and it says, okay, you might be the sole owner of this, but it doesn't mean you're the only one that views that art. And that's the thing. It's sort of like the shared view ownership. Like, I can go right now and, you know, Beeple had the most expensive NFT collection in history. I stand to be corrected, but I think the amount that the NFT collection sold for was about $31 million. Might even mean more than that. But that was 5,000 different digital artworks that were sold online. I can go and download absolutely any one of those and view them, or, you know, have the entire collection on my wall. There's only one owner, though. Only one person can actually sell that entire collection. And that's really where the space gets quite interesting.
And so it's gotten quite interesting for me in my world of sport, is that LeBron James bought his rookie card, and we know how big the sports cards are in America. And LeBron bought his own rookie card, I believe, for $1 million, like on the day it was done. So, and it's really, really interesting.
At Trump.
Well, that would have been my question to Sean, is like, in that world, I know when I'm going to a fair, I'm buying a card from somebody. So, like, does LeBron buy it from the NBA because they do hold all the rights for players, or who would you buy it from? Yeah.
It would depend on who's the NFT issuer. So just like, you know, you would have some sort of cryptocurrency development team that would launch these tokens into the market, there would be some sort of an issuer for that NFT. And they would do some promotional work. There's generally terms attached to the work that they do as well.
All right.
Something which was fascinating.
Listen,
I know we're running out of time.
Yeah. Go on.
Sorry, I'll be one second. Yeah, so what's quite interesting is that there was NFT Top Shop, I don't know if you guys ever heard of Top Shop and Top Shots. I'm not going to go into the Topshop thing because we don't have time, but Top Shots was essentially collections. So we're talking about baseball cards that you can collect.
Yes.
But instead of collecting a card, you collect a moment. So it could be this slam dunk that happens at the end of a game, or this like incredible pass, or whatever that may be. And only two or three or five people can actually own each of these moments. When they get replayed again on ESPN or, you know, any of the channels, you're able to take some of the royalties from that. And that's sort of where the space is going, which is like mind blowing because it's not something we thought about a year or two ago. But that's now the future of crypto. So on that note, I can then say that the space is getting a lot bigger. And it's going to be the awesome. Future, as we said before as well, is going to be weird. It's already pretty weird.
Well, I mean,
I want to sell the NFT of the day I dunked on my ex.
Well, okay, Gilly.
this is why we never run out of things to talk to Sean about, and we do get to chat to you almost every week. And I've never had a morning where we've gone, all right, well, we've pretty much spoken about everything. Thanks, Sean. Cheers. Bye-bye. It's constantly evolving, developing, and it's interesting for everybody to get involved in. And you don't have to spend a lot of money. You don't have to put all of your life savings into crypto. But you need to have a little bit of a diversified portfolio, and you need to do that by going over to Revex.com, sign up for free, verify your ID, add funds, however much you want. Select the bundle of your choice and get involved. Don't be one of those people who gets left behind. Thank you, Sean. Nice to see you, dude.
Great, guys. Thanks so much.
Awesome. Have a good day. Awesome. Cheers. And that brings us to the end of the first hour of this morning. We've still got more to come, including Snare, who is overseas in America, who's going to catch us up on her life. She moved to the U.S. nine years ago, from Durban, to be a nanny in her gap year, and she has stayed there ever since. She's had a lovely time in the U.S. Going to find out how that's working out for her. And we've got Gilly up to, we've got Bulelo. I see lots of activity happening in the background there, Mbula.
It's getting going.
Yeah, it's finally...
Yeah, well, the thing about running a cult is you've got to have... in business, Warren Buffett calls it finders, minders, and you get grinders. Yeah, so I've got to get my guys, obviously, get the lights going when I look like I'm going to take off like Jesus or whatever, you know?
Well, check all of that shit out just now. CliffCentral.com on a Wednesday morning. CliffCentral.com